This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Steve Brooks. Today I'm talking to Nunzio Esposito, VP, Head of Experience at Infor. Hi, Nunzio.
Hi, how you doing?
You had an article recently where you said the design philosophy was always only exactly what the user needs right now. Is that still the philosophy? And can you just explain a bit about that?
Yeah, I would tell you that definitely is our mandate or our mission, but it is challenging at times. I would tell you that the reason why we put ourselves in that mindset is because we're trying to answer a user's needs any moment within either their journey at work or the ways in which they want to engage with work. And I say engage with work because it doesn't mean sometimes it's in a single point, like physical space. It could be mobile, it could be transit, on the go. The reason why we say always only exactly what the user needs right now is also an internal mantra. Because typically when you have such deep capabilities and features that Infor offers, you end up wanting to surface all of those types of capabilities either on screen or within a workflow because you think that's what a user wants to have control over. What we've realized through our design maturity at Infor is that simplifying the screens is one thing, but simplifying the right information to be able to extract what someone really needs at a point in their journey, that's where the challenge lies. It's been interesting given the fact that we have so many user roles that present themselves inside of our software per industry.
How has AI helped that? Because you didn't put wants right now, you put needs right now. The question is the user doesn't always know what they need at any given point in time. And AI is obviously coming in now, actually can surface different things as well, rather than just what we, in a sense, humans or the designers can think of in the first instance.
That's where the change at Hook and Loop is happening inside of Infor. We were initially had such a strong view of the visual design of the software and the experience, and now it's really starting to design with more data in mind and understanding the cataloging and the harmony between the data. Because the better that we understand those types of clusters, then the better we can take advantage of the AI to then challenge the norms or the expectations that an end user has so that we can give them what they really need, not what they want, which you were just elaborating. A lot of that comes with a lot of our hands-on engagements with our customers, but most of the time those engagements also lead to they don't know. It's somewhat of a balance. That's why we try to get such a mixed bag, as I like to call it, in a room to challenge the status quo of the way in which we're looking at a specific feature enhancement, could be a complete rewrite, or even just an acquisition of software that we might have acquired. It always goes through the lens of design.
When you say the lens of design, do you have a methodology that you use? In a sense, one internally, and do you use one with customers?
We definitely use one internally and one with customers. Not that we don't see them as combined, but you're working with different people. And at the end of the day, design is not just how it looks, it's also how it functions. And the modularity between all of the different contexts that it needs to be. And then at the end of the day, when decisions go to get made, you're dealing with two different types of entities, as I like to call them. So from a customer's perspective, it's very hands-on. I would tell you, I know a lot of pros and cons when it comes to design thinking. I think it's applicable for validating smaller chunks of problem areas, but when it comes to such a macro view that it's applied to, it's very hard to translate putting it into work, like putting it into practice. We do it with customers, though, because it gets them comfortable in thinking differently, potentially seeing that a change can happen. And that's a good switch or a trigger from a mindset perspective.
Are you talking about prototyping there or just ideating?
Well, I think it's all those steps. Definitely, it's hands-on workshops, identifying where the business opportunity is, where the product opportunity is, and then understanding the collateral that comes out of that, which usually leads to business or operational changes to actually get it adopted and be engaged, embraced. And then you go through a series, which is somewhat industry best practice or standard, which is a series of prototypes, validation to a segment. If that validation is warrant, typically that sits there, and then it begs the question, well, what do we do next? When you go to what do you do next, that's where feasibility comes into play. That's why design at an enterprise level really needs to evolve to be able to understand the how, not just the want.
Feasibility being?
It's like, can I?
Does it have a business case, or is it all part of that?
I would say it's all part of that. If you do the first process correctly, you have viability. It's wanted by the business. There's a value conversion there, and they see that, hey, if you can get this capability or if you can do X, Y, and Z, there's impact there, there's a benefit. The feasibility piece, I think, is where a lot of challenges lie, and that's in where's all the data coming from, what systems need to be connected, what kind of APIs do we have, are those APIs too granular? If we're going to use this piece of technology, how modern is it, or is it at the standards of where our design system is and what it's offering, so that we can even just create consistency between all of our applications? The feasibility is definitely from a UX engineering mindset, more than from like a solving a business problem perspective.
Something you said earlier, you said the customers don't always know what they want. How do you approach that? How do you find out what the customers need? Or it's normally, I assume, you're going in because they've got a challenge and they don't know how to address that challenge generally.
This one is somewhat more of an art than a science, because you have a lot of different opinions and a different type of stakeholders, or even just hierarchy from an organization that you're engaging with. And you're battling with who wants what and what they expect. What ends up happening through the design process is that you do come up with numerous solutions. If you come from an agency type of mindset where you're trying to provide a service to a customer, you need to apply that then from enterprise thinking. So what I mean by that is you're not trying to come up with the holy grail, the singular answer that is going to solve all of the problems, but you're probably going to give them an option which answers what they're asking directly, and you present that. You have that as a POC. What you should do with that then is challenge some of the norms of what you heard and take somewhat of your own IP and knowledge of the industry or cross-industry and apply it to what that solution should be, and also present that as well. So what we end up doing is we'll create or work hands-on with the customer, and we'll have an adjacent POC happening at the same time. That helps to create not only internal tension around which one is more viable, but it also creates options then to the subject matters that we're engaged with. And that, we found, is the key to changing the mindset for them to see a new way of doing work.
I assume it also helps in reducing the choice of do nothing as well.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that at times. You get sometimes my team jokes internally, like, so I guess we're just going to put that on a shelf. That happens with a lot of design organizations of any software company. They all have a lot of good ideas. We see enhancements or new capabilities as potentially being a differentiator or a game changer. Like a lot of things, it sometimes requires timing, financing, customer demand, and pieces like that in the market. Yeah, we try to pull from our archive as much as we possibly can too, and even challenge ourselves in some of those solutions given how fast technology or our own capabilities have evolved.
What is the perfect UI?
Oof. If you talk to some analysts, they're going to go, the perfect UI is no UI. And they say that from a conversational standpoint, but there's no silver bullet. I'd tell you that that's a very tough question to answer. If you try to look at enterprise software against some of the more consumer-grade type experiences, and you'll hear this a lot in the industry, we want it to be like the Amazon experience, or they'll go, why can't it be like how we consume content in social media? Why can't our work applications be like that? They're all asking the wrong thing. What those types of experiences are serving are totally different ways of consuming and engaging with content, and the inputs and outputs are different. So from a business application standpoint, what I call GSD, getting bleep done or getting stuff done, do you really want two swipes to validate the workflow of configuring an airline craft jet in order that FedEx just placed with Boeing? Probably not, because you're going to need to have high trust and confidence that for within two swipes, that's going to be the correct, there's going to be accuracy there. I would tell you the perfect UI is driven by asking and developing the right use cases, understanding then the scale in which there are variants within making those decisions, and then applying a methodical stance in the way in which componentry, meaning smaller granular aspects of the UI, are applied. An example would be, what does a button look like? Or what kind of icon needs to be here? To me, as fast-paced as design is going, that's becoming a commodity, and that's not really what UX represents.
One of the things you haven't mentioned there, but I've heard it from Infor, Triumph Motorcycles being one potential client, one client, are we going to see personalized UI? There's lots of conversations about different generations and how different generations want different things and expect different things. Are we going to see personalized UI? It's not just about the colors you see on screen, because obviously you have some people with color blindness and need a different screen color. Are we actually going to see personalized UI develop where different people actually, you want to see a different interface, actually have the opportunity to have it?
The answer is yes. And with the advancements of AI, that's where that really gets to take shape. It's less about the visual aspect and more around the personalization of the data and the system being able to know what you end up doing, say, in a more repetitive frequency standpoint, and how then the application needs to respond to that. Right now, we're coming from a place where personalization is what you just said, which is, I want my header to be blue, or my company is red, like Infor, and I want to make sure that my red logo is there. We tend to think that that's personalization, but
That's branding.
Exactly. And that's why we call it theming. As we've gone through our evolution, those are themes. And we have different types of contrast, or taking accessibility into account, which you used. But personalization really is going to come to the system knowing what I need, and that can be based on time, based on place, meaning context, where I am at work, and probably the frequency or the patterns in which I'm doing specific tasks or workflows. I think that that's where the personalization lies.
That sounds more like optimization to me. Personalization, do you not feel that if you look at the younger generation who are born with iPads in their hands, are they going to want touch screens in the workplace? Well, possibly yes. I get the point, you don't necessarily want swipe left, swipe right for your next Boeing decision.
Yeah, but I would tell you I think we're already there. While a lot of the times we present to our customers or our decision makers, where they're coming from is more terminal type of engagements with software. But the reality is we have all of that type of mobility already in play. The customers, and this is probably more broadly across all of enterprise, they haven't really seen that next generation really enter their workplace. What's happening is they're not going there to work. And that's the real problem. And Kevin alluded to that, our CEO, around the challenges in the workforce. And that's not just in technology. That's everywhere. That's in manufacturing. That's in distribution. You see that even in trade. Until there's a demand, and I think there's a change in the demographics of the way in which the employee base is changing, then that's the only time that you will start to see then the application respond for it, because then there's a need. That's why we've done so much when it comes to HCM. And in HCM, we have an experience that we call is adaptive. If you're a user that only has access to 1 to 3 things, there's an entirely different experience for that. It is personalized, but what I mean by that, it's themed, and it's configurable to a user based on the data that they want to see. When you get to a role...
Need to see.
Or they need to see. I like that. Thank you for correcting me. When you go to a user, which we classified as a super user... That's what we call one-to-many or one-to-N. They have a totally different experience. And those want to be laser-focused. They don't want to see a lot of change. They want quicker ways to input data. They actually want to see all the data. And that's a challenge all on its own for us to solve from a UX perspective.
How fast is voice being adopted? The voice technology isn't quite there in a lot of cases, but it is improving slowly. How close are we, and how is it going to evolve in the next few years?
First of all, I agree with you. I don't think it really has taken off as much as I think we all expected. It's still definitely at its infancy. You look how it came into our homes. That's really where it was first applicable, first applied, the consumerization of it. We all still tend to use it for more simpler type tasks. Like I wake up every day and I just go, hey, Alexa, what's the weather? Because I just need to know that. But I don't use it to answer mathematical equations or help my stepdaughter with her homework. When you go to put that into business... There's challenges there. We have a couple of customers that have been early adopters. They've been using it for shipping and receiving of goods out of a DC, which you saw on main stage from Grimco. It obviously has some time savings, but there's still some hiccups there because it doesn't work as cognitively fluid as we tend to have exchanges and conversations. So because there's a pause, a user tends to feel that there's a lack of trust or confidence in the way in which they're engaging with, say, the digital assistant. It ends up losing business adoption. That's the hiccup there. What would be better with it would be to have it aggregate and understand the data that's going on behind the scenes and be used as more from an insights perspective than a way in which to input data and get an output back. So an example would be, I'm working, everything is going on in my day, and let's just say that I have an analytical dashboard that I need. You know, I'm a road warrior. I operate a certain territory, and I'm on the road. I'm getting inputs on a customer that I need to engage with. I would rather have the AI just blatantly be like, hey, heads up. You need to stop here because not wait for me to be like, hey, Coleman, or hey, Alexa, or hey, Google.
QuickBooks have a futuristic video where they have an AI which tells the driver what the current business situation is in their business, and that's, I think, what you're talking about. I think it's Tieto in Finland have an AI as their board member, and so the AI actually tells them all the results and actually tells them the analytics as part of their board, and it sits on the board in their board meetings. That's quite good, and that's kind of where you're going with this, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's also a comfort level in all of that, too. We're creatures of human behavior, human habit, and that's why some of those things tend to not be so more broadly accepted, is I think what I'm trying to say.
People are talking about frictionless UI a lot. What does that mean to you? What kind of advances are you making in that space?
Some of this stuff is more foundational. You said optimized a little bit earlier, but obviously that's a first step in creating a frictionless experience. It's questioning, do we really need all of those controls listed in a tertiary navigation bar within one of our applications? Really, you only need these three, and this can be truncated. Optimizing decision-making is obviously, I would say, a more baseline type of example. Where we would like to take it, though, is really empowering the power of the aggregated data to understand what a user needs within the journey and only presenting one or two options to make a decision, because that's all that that decision tree really navigates towards.
Next most likely steps.
That's a good way of saying it. We built out a prototype back in 2017, built on that methodology, and took a very strong stance in the modularity of design, and we challenged ourselves to try to say, how could we take an entire cloud suite and essentially develop it with really only three patterns in mind. And that was a really good exercise. And we time boxed it. I hate innovation for the sake of innovation, because then it ends up just being innovation. So we time boxed it for 3 weeks, and we came out with this POC that to this day we continue to reflect on, unpack, and take some of those learnings into decisions that we're making now. We're just not there yet. And it's a combination of data aggregation and harmonizing it. It's a combination of customers willing to open up the doors of that data floodgate, which means third-party data and public data, as I would like to say. And then it requires the correct tech infrastructure from an API standpoint to be able to really power that type of performance and efficiency.
What about empathy? Because more and more people are talking about empathy in terms of having empathic systems.
The empathy piece, I'm chuckling a little bit because from an R&D perspective, it's extremely challenging. And that's why I'm saying it. I'm saying it because while empathy works for a one-on-one or a one-to organization standpoint, it doesn't tend to scale because each person's expectations, what they demand from an engagement or even from a application is different. And that's why personas, doing all this market research and segments, it gets you a step closer, but it doesn't really get you to be what maybe you and I would classify as true empathy.
Personalized empathy? Is that what you're talking about?
I like that you're saying personalized, but personalized has been so bastardized in this industry that it's not even enough. We end up saying personal because personal is singular and feels more internal when you say it. Psychologically, there's a higher level of relatability that comes with that. When you say personalized, you went to, isn't that just branding? And I'm going, I call it theming. There's a lot of nuances there. We try to be as empathetic as we possibly can in our process. But at the end of the day, anybody who's building a system for many needs to account for variancy and scale while they're making those decisions.
Don't know if there's been any research into change management in the younger generation who are more used to their apps changing. But even, to be honest, the younger generation whinge if something changes.
I love where you were going with the questions because it's the same thing I tell internally to my team. They have aspirations of being, why can't Infor or another enterprise-type design organization, let's just say SAP, Oracle, I mean, there's many out there now. Why can't we do something bleeding edge, latest, greatest, and get that deployed and widely adopted? And the reality is, it's just like you said, depends or because. What works for one doesn't necessarily mean it works for all. And that's why consumer grade is actually not applicable. It sounds so messed up that I'm saying that because I still go off that target. That's still the target. I want it to be somewhat fun in the experience and make work feel really meaningful because of that. But the change management, getting it to work from company A to company B, the special types of requirements that they may have, starts to drag that experience needs to be.
You have to bring every individual along with you, don't you? That's the problem.
It was probably maybe 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago, and this is the most simplest example, but just Instagram. Why do we go on there? Passive consumption. We're bored. It's innately wired in us that we need to look at the latest photo. But I go on there too. I'm not going to deny it. And as I scroll through it, they change the icons to just black and white, and they change the logo. Well, if you're in design, that caused like the massive ripple effect. People are like, we love it. We hate it. Why the F did you do that? Like, you know, it's like an uproar. It was just a change in iconography, and it created that type of effect. Now, sure, granted, no one's complaining now, but it took adoption. It took you seeing that I still need to use this, so I got to figure that out. And if I want to continue to engage with it, I guess I have to embrace it. I'm using that as such a small example, because then you got a super user that's been using M3 for 22 years, and you go, I've changed your workflow.
Which is kind of where I was going, and it's like, some people like spreadsheets, some people like talking to the system, some people like using OCR, I just want to take a photo.
And now try doing that when you have an organization you're working with that has 400,000 users, and then multiply that by 2,000 customers, and now you have, let's just say, 1 million-plus users, and they're going, don't change this on me, when some are going, change this on me. And that's why personal is where it needs to go.
And where do you think we will be in about 10 years' time? Blue sky.
Blue sky? Wow. It's not blue ocean strategy. We're talking blue sky, just going totally out there. Well, I'll tell you this. I had a conversation going to Penn Station because I live in New Jersey and commute to our office in New York. And I was talking to our director of UX engineering. And he's like, where do you think we need to go with our design system? I said, well, reality is, while we're making a design system, everybody else is making a design system. While we're doing data aggregation and cataloging, everybody's doing data aggregation and cataloging. It's kind of one for one, punch for punch. But if I were to go, I don't know if it's 10 years out, but maybe it's 20 or 30, I would tell you you're probably looking at singularity of the experience, where there's, let's just say, one UI is a good way to translate what I'm saying. And what ends up coming out of that is that you get that personal experience based on your engagement with the application and what it needs to do for you, and the data that is really around you as an entity, that entity amongst many entities, and those entities accounting for all the assets and the production that a business needs to operate around. I think it's singularity from a user experience perspective, but very hyper-personal when it comes to who I am, who I have around me from what I engage with, and what are the expectations of my role and my job. And while that might seem very elusive, it's hard to translate.
Can I put another suggestion in there? Blue sky-wise, at some point we will each have a personal AI, and at some point my personal AI will interact with the business AI. Those interactions, my personal AI understands my concerns, my likes, my requirements, and the AIs actually talk. And having had that conversation, then you can then surface the interface the actual individual user wants at that given time.
You're tagging AI on it. If I was having this conversation with my wife, I'd be like, simpatico, she's Spanish, meaning we have a very similar viewpoint. I can sympathize with that. I don't know if it's necessarily AI, though, because I think at that point we probably transcended ourselves to our alter self, meaning digitally. So you can classify it as that, but it just means that we probably have somewhat of a digital clone of who we are in this physical world based on those types of patterns and behaviors and your expectations, your requirements. Those requirements then are going to mean that you might be collaborating with people of either like mind or opposite sides of this continuum to get stuff done, meaning get work done. But I think you're going to have a ton of insights that you never had at your disposal today, which is going to ultimately change the way in which you make decisions.
The reason I say personal AI is because a personal AI holds your personal data. It means you don't present your personal data to the business AI. Okay. The business AI just talks to your personal AI, who then can hand out the decisions based on your personal preferences and individuality. So in a sense, if you want to go and buy something that is not normal for a classification, which is well beyond the realms, the business AI doesn't necessarily need to know that you're buying for yourself, you're buying for your wife or husband or whatever. there's a protection element around that personal AI, which you wouldn't get if you hand all your data over to a business AI. But there is an intelligence around it because it knows what it can't surface. The bank or whatever, interrogate your AI and say, actually, would you want this kind of offer? And ultimately, it does that negotiation for you. So in the end, the human just has to make the actual decision.
It's funny you brought that up. As you're taking me into how you're defining that, you look at Apple and you look at what they're doing around your health data. You're collecting it in this repository, and then you're either opting in or opting out on how you want to share that information to and who. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you are empowered to retain that information. Now you're saying apply science to that. We can get into very interesting types of interactions or engagements. Yeah, totally. Totally. When it comes to work and business, we get very obsessed with innovation and new types of technology and capabilities. But the problem is it doesn't ever really translate in the ripple effect to truly transcend a business. It's like we're a laggard.
Businesses don't change that quickly.
They don't. And we get very obsessed with what the market is saying and what new capabilities are out there, but we don't understand how they're applied to ourselves.
Because Amazon goes killed now, I think.
Yeah, it comes out, it leaves. You don't know what's going to stay. Is that just a trend? Is it applicable to what I need to do? Would my employees like it? What are my customers going to go do with that? If this customer in APAC, is that going to work in, say, Europe? Is it going to work in North America? You have to take culture into play, demographics into play. There's a lot of complexities there.
The answer is always it depends.
Is that how I should start answering your questions? It depends.
I don't know whether it was Hook and Loop that did it, but I think a couple of years ago I saw an augmented reality on Infonexus. Mm-hmm. Are you doing anything around augmented reality now?
We've learned a lot through that. It was a POC in the beginning to build out how we could visualize supply chain and the data points along that entire journey end to end. And we learned a ton. We learned a lot. And that's why you now have Control Center from Infonexus, which is a little bit more, I would say, flatter in the way it presents itself to an end user, but it's just as insightful. What we ended up doing through those learnings, though, and it didn't just go on a shelf, but we did apply it in distribution. So in Cloud Suite distribution, we have an early adopter that is using augmented reality from PickPack, picking at a DC center, knowing where the parts bins are and all those other pieces to save time in order to put together an order or a configured item. We've been playing with it there. We're working on then now scaling those types of learnings so that can be a configuration within the core of the application. Other places where it works really well is just from an analytical dashboard perspective, which at times you need to apply image recognition to it as well. It ends up giving you what we like to call like a deeper lens. Many layers of information around an item or a place. And that's where we've seen there be a lot of viability. But as far as the scale of it being applied, it's not widely adopted. That comes with some of the things that I would tell you even Rod was talking about with our new ways of doing our deployment methodology. And it comes down to mindset and the willingness to want to do something different that is not the way you currently do it, and you see value that comes out of it.
Thank you very much, Nunzio.
No, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.